And now we're speaking with Rabbi David Miviser. Now, David is Rabbi Emeritus at the Ahavat Olam Synagogue in Vancouver. And he also presided over the Liberation Seder that was held here in Hamilton, one of several that have been held yearly now. So we're very pleased to have him in the studio. David, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you so much, too.
Well, I met you for the first time yesterday, and like everyone else there, I was quite interested in what you had to say. And I can see why Robert Allison wanted to bring you to Hamilton to preside over this special event we have. In fact, let's start with that because that's fun. We heard at the Seder that Robert Allison literally almost ran into you. He was at the market or something getting groceries.
Yeah,
how did you run into Robert?
Well, it was fantastic, actually. I went to the art crawl on the second Friday night months ago. I remember it was in the middle of the winter. Possibly it was December. I don't exactly remember. But I was at the art crawl, and I saw this kind of card table sitting out there on the sidewalk. And a man and a woman behind the card table, and they had some bottles of Palestinian olive oil and some books by Jeff Halper about war on the people. And then a banner on the front of the table that said Jewish Liberation Theology Institute. And me, being a rabbi living in Canada for 22 years, I've never heard of this thing. I thought, like, what? Who are these imposters? No, that's a joke. What is this Jewish Liberation Institute thing that where people are out on the street on a Friday night in Hamilton, Ontario, of all places, selling Palestinian olive oil and Jeff Halper's book and keffiyehs? So it's kind of intrigued. And I started talking with Robert Allison, who's the tall, slender guy, and Lucia, his partner, who was sitting at the table. And we had a great conversation. And I learned that, among other things, every year they have a Liberation Seder here in Hamilton, which is great. It's great. A Seder really thoughtfully, intentionally dedicated to the liberation of Palestine. And Lucia is very pregnant with a baby. They were saying to me, well, they're not going to be able to do it this year because Lucia's going to, you know, they're going to have a baby right before the Seder. And how could they possibly run a Seder with a brand new baby? Yeah. And I said, well, I could run the Seder. And we just made a deal right then and there.
It's very fortuitous, almost divine intervention. Well, it's funny.
What do you mean almost?
Yeah, you mentioned Jeff Halper there, and that's interesting because we've brought him to Hamilton to speak, and he might have even been on this program. I can't remember for sure, but it's certainly we've talked about him. You're involved in social justice struggles and struggles for liberation over there. You were just telling me you've been to Israel and Palestine, so you're working with people there.
Yes. I've lived there four different years of my life, going back to 1971. I've been connected with Jeff for years and years, and one of the striking things in my memory is I was living there in the spring of 2001 with my wife of the time and young children, and Jeff, with his organization called the Israel Campaign Against
House
Demolitions, and another great organization, Rabbis for Human Rights, were asked by a leader of Palestinians in a village, the village is called Haras, if they would come to Haras and help stop the settlers who were cutting trees, shooting holes into their water tanks on top of their roofs that they need to have water, smashing their pipes that would bring water to their fields, actually even shooting into the windows of their houses, you know. And they thought that if we were there, the violence might tone down a bit. So Jeff organized a trip along with Rabbi Arik Asherman. And it was actually four of us that went. It was so teeny. It was the two of them and me and somebody else. And we walked through that village. And that was such an exposure for me. It was things that, you know, you read about things, maybe a lot of the listeners right now, like, read about so much stuff going on in Palestine, and they read so much stuff that the settlers do and the army does and the horrible things. And you read about it, and you can kind of, like, picture it in your mind. But if you're actually there and you, like, see it right in front of your eyes, it's just, it's, like, shocking on a whole different level, you know? And so much happened that day. There was, like, confrontations between Palestinian youth and actually Israeli youth who are armed with machine guns, you know, and the Palestinians have stones, you know, right in the middle of that. And It's just an incredible experience. So I've been with Jeff lots of times.
It seems to be a transformative experience when people go down there and see for themselves what happened. I know one of our members of the Coalition to Stop the War, Henry Evans Tenbrink, you know, he was at the ISM back in 2000, around then. And after you do that, it changes you, and you're going from just doing certain types of work, labor related and social justice, to also helping with Palestine. If you weren't doing that before, visiting there often compels people to do that. And we have people in Hamilton that have seen that. They're either from Palestine and are quite knowledgeable about it, or they're Arab people who are sympathetic, or now there are many Canadians who have been exposed to the issue, people that have been living here who have not. Don't have a homeland attachment to Palestine or Israel, but have become involved. Plus, now we have Jewish people who are sort of waking up and talking about this as well. So, you know, that's why we have this interfaith, this liberation seder that in which people from all over are present. And this time it was held at the New Vision United Church. And United Church has been very friendly and helpful in this endeavor. Yeah. And again, we had Christians, Jews, Muslims, people of other faiths that were present. And it was a full house. It sold out in the last day. Someone made an announcement in the anti-war coalition list, and the last 10 seats got filled up. And we were worried we were going to have to, Robert was worried he was going to have to turn people away. Fortunately, it turned out to be that. There was a lot of logistical work to get things running at the last minute, but you wouldn't have known that as an ordinary participant. You came in, you had so much to say about this experience, about the Seder, about tradition for Jewish people, and what it means to bring the issue of social justice, of ending suffering, of ending violence into the present, you know,
absolutely
renewing things. And that was just so interesting. We've talked a bit about the Liberation Seder on this program in the past with Robert and others who have been involved. It's a special Haggadah. It's different than what other people might have traditionally experienced. You had mentioned at the outset there's these anti-hierarchical components. There's this feminist approach that is newly present, and that's really interesting. There's new chants, new variations. What I found interesting about your approach that I didn't notice in previous Liberation Seders was the emphasis you placed on interaction with the people who are present. It was a more of a participatory thing. More than that, you were taking questions, you were encouraging questions. Because so many people there are not Jewish, of course, and they're probably, yesterday was mostly Christian people there, now that I think about it, who probably have not been to a Seder. And you are encouraging people to ask questions about things they might not understand about what's happening. And for people that had experienced the Seder in the past, the different approach you took had generated a lot of interest. People were asking about words and the way that they were being used differently. Someone mentioned the word Shekinah, and that they thought you were using it differently than what they had experienced in the past. I'm wondering if you could elaborate on that.
All right. Well, you know, let me talk about asking questions at a Seder. And just for anybody that doesn't know, the Seder is a meal that we have on the first night of Passover. Some also have it again on the second night. And it's very structured. The word Seder literally means order. Something has an order to it. So it's a meal that is kind of the venue for a structured ritual that has very particular foods that have symbolic meaning, and we talk about things, and it's a very liturgical meal. Liturgical means that there's like almost like a script that we read, and it's in a little book called a Haggadah. You used that word just before. So I'm going to play rabbi here and do a little bit of teaching for people that don't already know this. So where does that come from at all? Why is that done in our Jewish tradition? And the answer is it goes back roughly about 2,000 years. Prior to 2,000 years ago, there was a temple in Jerusalem. And if you just read in the Bible, if you read, say, the book of Exodus, the book of Leviticus, you'll see the way Passover was celebrated was with the sacrifice of animals. We would sacrifice sheep and turtle doves and, you know, critters like that would be slaughtered, and their blood would get splattered here and there by priests in Jerusalem. And the Romans, I want to say, kind of did us the favor of getting rid of that institution, and a deeper meaning and a more personal connection with what was going on could come forward after the priesthood, and this is anti-hierarchical, after that was gone. But even before that was gone, just people had traditions and rituals that they lived with. So it says in the book of Exodus a number of times, the same night when the Passover happened, it was a certain night in the year, it happened to be the full moon of this month that we're in now, the month of springtime at the full moon, you do this ritual. And when your child asks you, what's it about? Then you can tell them the story. So actually, if there's no asking of questions, there's no real telling. Like, when, it's very hard to teach someone something if they're not curious and they're not asking questions. We've probably all been in that situation where someone is trying to teach us something and we're not really listening, right? But hey, if we have questions, we're really looking for the answers, right? And that will end up being dialogical, right? It'll be a conversation. So the word in the Bible in Hebrew where it says you shall tell is v'higadata. And the little book that you just referred to, Brendan, is called a Haggadah. And the whole purpose of the Seder is to set it up so the questions are asked. And rather than ritualized liturgical questions that are written down in a book, and you read the same question the same way and you sing it in the same little chant, 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 real questions are really the things that we are concerned about, we're puzzled over, huge questions. So the classic four questions that most Jewish listeners would know about, and maybe some non-Jewish listeners will know, oh yes, the youngest child reads the four questions. In our tradition, that is encountered for the first time written down in the Mishnah that was written around the year 200. 1,800 years ago. But in the Mishnah, it says, if the child doesn't have any questions to ask, have them read this. So the presumption is that a child would have questions. That should be the starting point. What are our questions? And if everybody's sitting there looking around at each other, I don't know, do you have any questions? Nah, I don't have any questions. Do you have any questions? Nah, it's all fine with me. Well, then we have some questions to rely on.
Yeah, it's incredible.
So that's the default, or not the default. That's like the last resort. Well, what questions do we have? Like, why is the world this way? Why haven't we changed it well enough since that time? They had slavery back then. What are we living with now? What can we do about it? How can we get over it? You know, does it have to be the way it is, or can we change it? You know, if you want to think in religious terms, you know, really— like the prophet said, what doth the Lord require of us? You know, do justice, love mercy, walk humbly with your God. How do we do that? I mean, these are real questions. So no one should be surprised to have questions at a Seder. In fact, that's what the Seder is for.
I'm just so glad you mentioned that, because certainly, I mean, with my family and similar Seders I've been to, at a certain point, it seems routinized that people just default right to the questions that are already written down. And you're referring to core issues of justice that have permeated the religion for thousands of years. And now you're bringing that back, because that's why people were assembled yesterday, because they have questions about social justice and about making the world whole and healing it and so on. And, you know, the interpretation of words like Shekinah was one that came up.
Yeah, I was supposed to talk about that. You want me to talk about that?
Oh, sure, I mean.
Okay, so one of the words that came up is a replacement for the usual liturgical reference to God. And I just want people to always remember that the institutionalized forms of religion that we have all inherited, whatever religion we're associated with, we're kind of locked into place long after people's own like religious impulses were expressed in many different ways. You know, so within our religion, if we look way, way, way back in the beginning, there's many different expressions of people's relationship with the divine and the transcendent. You know, people just expressed it in many different ways. But then as centuries went by, certain things got kind of locked in and they were given like authority by people who pretty much took authority to themselves and said, this is the way we should do it. So in the Jewish tradition, people are usually accustomed to calling God Adonai. And even the word Adonai itself is a way to say something that's written down in different letters, the four-lettered name of God, sometimes called the Tetragrammaton, the letters Yud, Hey, Vav, Hey. which in the Bible is the name of God. So people in the last generation or so have been thinking that's a very male-identified, kind of masculine-identified name of God. We don't think of God as being male or masculine. It's translated as my Lord or the Lord, and Lord itself is very hierarchical. A Lord is something that's over you, you know, that you have to subject yourself to. That may be a dimension of God that people experience. Yes, God is bigger and more powerful than any of us, but that's not the only thing about God that we want to name. So within Jewish tradition, there are many names of God, and another way to think about God is named Shekhinah. And Shekhinah, first of all, it's a feminine word, so it like evokes, literally gives voice to the feminine qualities of the divine. And Shekhinah literally is the indwelling presence of the divine, so that the divine is transcendent. The wholeness of the divine is beyond what we can grasp and comprehend. It's just too big and too much for us, mere humans living here on this earth. We can get parts of it, but we don't get the whole thing. The part that we get is the part that's here, and it's the part that's among us. And I think I said last night, I like, you know, saying that the divine is present, you know, in flowers and trees and streams, and it's present between us when we're with each other. It's within us. If I can just be quiet and feel what's really inside me. You know, there is something divine within me that makes me be alive, just makes me be. It's in my consciousness. It's in my unconsciousness. So all that that's close and that's in here, in this world, in the Hebrew Jewish tradition, we call that side of it all Shekhinah. So we intentionally use that word. And I like knowing that a very similar word is used in the Muslim tradition, in Arabic, Sakina. It's exactly parallel to the Hebrew Shekhinah. And it's the quiet, inner, you know, present part of the divine that we can experience in this world.
Yes. What I'm getting the sense that all of the elements involved, from the tradition to interpretations to justice itself, all is very multidimensional in the way you're approaching it.
It is.
And sometimes we forget or leave behind important parts of a religion or a ceremony or a tradition. And I see you reviving important elements of the theology that have been present this whole time that other people are trying to bring about as well. And also to change things and turn them on their head. And of course, the Seder discusses stories that involve blood, that involve suffering, that involve killing. And that is where we're coming from historically. That's where we're coming from in the tradition, in a sense. There's serious wrongs, there's oppression and people fleeing oppression and all of these things. You're also trying to say that this is the past, this is where we're coming from, this is problems that exist today, but we're also looking towards removing oppression, towards healing suffering.
That's the purpose of it. The value of remembering something from the past is so that we can do better in the future. And the whole purpose of repeating the story is to help us remember that the way things are isn't the way they have to be, right? We are living today with so many structural oppressions built into the society that we live in that for many of us it can look like it's never going to change. We can't change it enough. The government is so rigid, right? I'm going to say it. Even if we vote in somebody who promises to change our electoral system, someone who promotes himself as an environmental leader, you know, even if we vote for that guy and then he ditches all these promises, you know, we can feel that we're stuck in a hopeless situation. What can we do about it? So I think the story of Passover is worth retelling because it says there's something operative in this world beyond what we can see and there's any tangible evidence, you know. So we should be inspired and we should be strengthened and we should keep really struggling with all allies that we can find anywhere, all people everywhere in solidarity, but knowing that there's something beyond the available evidence for what can possibly result, and never never give up hope, never give up the struggle. You know, and if we think about the story of the slaves in, you know, the Hebrew slaves in Egypt and many other slaves as well, they had no logical reason to ever think that they would ever go free. And actually, the story in the Bible is they cried out to God. They cried out to something beyond what they could see and touch and feel and experience every day. And there was something that kicked in at that time that enabled them eventually to go free. And it was, like you just said, it was bloody, it was dirty. You know, some people say if you want to make omelets, you got to break a few eggs, you know. But in the end, they went free. So that's the purpose of telling it. And something I said last night that I only learned through studying the arcane, obscure details in our Jewish tradition is our tradition talks about a Passover of the future. The prophet Jeremiah talked about this. You can read through the book of Jeremiah. There will be a day in the future when all people will be free, when all oppression will end. You know, the shackles of all the workers will fall off. They'll be broken off. Everyone will go free. Jeremiah talks about a Passover. Please remember, this is not literal. It's figurative. It's poetic language. He says there will be a Passover for Assyria, the great empire of that time, and a Passover for Egypt, the other great empire of that time, kind of like thinking of the two world superpowers. They will also experience a kind of a release and liberation from being in that position of having to be the empire. Being the empire itself exacts such a price from people, you know, to have to live as empire. This whole thing will fall away one day. He said that maybe 3,000 years ago, but we keep retelling the story as a way to energize ourselves and, you know, inspire ourselves to keep going with it.
Well, yes, there's, you know, people from yesterday coming from all these different backgrounds, you know, all coming from different places. But I think the things you're emphasizing, at the direction that people should be going in, is very important. And I think it was well received, you know, and I think that there's these efforts, and we were just talking about it before the program. In the United States, many young Jewish people are looking to cast off oppression in various ways, and they're not satisfied with what's been bequeathed to them. And they're not satisfied with standing still, you know? And I think, you know, we're at the very beginning of something that could see a lot more positive engagement, you know, in terms of people looking back and thinking, am I doing enough? As you said, the political structures, the problems that we're facing are very entrenched. It requires an enormous amount of work. But there are people that are willing to set out at the take the beginning of that journey. So your efforts on this are much appreciated. And you mentioned that there's this Institute for Jewish Liberation Theology being set up, and you know, it's all very interesting to watch. So, you know, I hope we see this continue to flower, that independent Jewish voices grows, that people have organizations through which they can engage positively in these struggles. So thanks very much just for being there yesterday. It was a stroke of luck. It was more than that, fortuitous that you could be there and help have another great Liberation Seder here in Hamilton. So Rabbi, thanks so much for coming in with us today.
Good. Thank you, too.